her lamps, then drops her bag between the wicker hamper and the bureau. As she transfers her clothing from suitcase to laundry or drawer, she clenches the unwrapped candy bar between her front teeth. Every so often, she bites into the crisp chocolate and frosty nougat, then expertly reaches out to catch the candy bar before it drops to the floor. In no time, she's devoured the whole thing. Her suitcase is empty, and she's still feeling unsatisfied. Unsettled. Well, there's a lot to do. I need to start a load of laundry. I need to check my email. I need to find my charger and charge my BlackBerry. But before any of that, she needs another Three Musketeers. She starts for the kitchen again. Then, seeing something out of the corner of her eye, she stops short. Slowly, she turns back toward the bed. Lying in the center of the puffy white duvet is something that wasn't there before she left on Friday. The truth hits her, hard, even before she steps closer to see what it is. Someone was in her apartment while she was gone. Chapter 2. Lucinda doesn't call Neil about the intrusion right away. She wants to, desperately, but she hates to disturb him at home, at night, on a holiday weekend. That's part of the reason. The rest of it has to do with her own irresponsibility. She should have changed the locks when she moved into the apartment. Any fool knows to do that. Recklessly, she'd ignored that basic precaution. And now she's paying the price. She might as well deal with it on her own, the way she's dealt with pretty much everything else that comes her way. This isn't a leaky faucet, though. Nor is it a cupboard mouse or a flat tire, both of which she has also recently handled on her own, thank you very much. This situation is far more disturbing, maybe even dangerous. This time, she needs help. From whom? Not Bradley, he's in New York. Not Cam, no need to alarm her yet. The police? Neil is the police. He'll know what to do. At last, she allows herself to pick up the phone and dial his number. Irma will answer, of course. She always does, usually on the first ring. She's the chatty type. Neil hates the telephone. But it's his gruff voice that greets Lucinda, and only after several rings. Neil, I'm sorry to bother you. Are you okay? Hell no. I am, but somebody broke into my apartment while I was... A piercing scream erupts in the background on Neil's end of the line. Hang on a second, Sin. She hears a rustling against the receiver as he covers it with his hand. Then his voice, only slightly muffled, bellows, Cut that out, Maeve. Poppy is on the phone. He returns to the line with a brusque apology. I didn't realize you had the grandkids there, Lucinda says, wishing she hadn't disturbed him. I'll let you get back to babysitting, Neil. I didn't mean to.
No, it's okay. Someone broke into your place, you said. How did they get in?
She hesitates. I have no idea. I can't tell. But chances are they had a key, unlocked the door, and walked right in.
Did you call the police?
I called you.
A robbery should be reported, Sin.
I know, but it wasn't a robbery. They didn't take anything. They actually left something.
What is it?
Lucinda hesitates, looking at the scrapbook still sitting in the middle of her bed. Maybe I should show it to you in person, she tells Neil. I know you're busy, but maybe tomorrow if...
The hell with tomorrow. Come on over. Or do you need me to come there instead?
No, I can come, she says hastily. He has the kids, and anyway, she doesn't want to spend another moment alone in this apartment. She hangs up the phone, still not entirely convinced she's alone here, even though she's checked all the closets under the bed and behind all the doors and the shower curtain, armed with a chef's knife, trembling, like a soon-to-be victim in one of those teen slasher movies. The only difference is that the frightened females on screen always, inexplicably, go from room to room in the dark. Not Lucinda. Every lamp, every overhead fixture, Every bare closet bulb in the entire apartment is now ablaze. There are no more shadows. There is no place for the boogeyman to hide. But he was here. With a shudder, she grabs her coat and her keys, then remembers to pull on her gloves again before picking up the scrapbook. Years of working police investigations made her do that even before she touched it the first time. Fingerprints. Leafing through the album, she was initially bewildered by the chronology of photocopied newspaper clippings mounted to the thick paper pages, each one featuring a beautiful college-aged woman who had committed suicide. They appeared to have lived and died, months, years, miles, worlds apart. Lucinda had no idea how they were connected to each other, much less to her. Then she spotted a familiar face in one of the photos, and the latter became clear. It was Cam's sister, Ava Neary. Not far from Society Hill lies the leafy South Philadelphia neighborhood now known, post-revitalization, as Pennsport. Lifelong resident Neil still refers to it by its bygone name, Two Street, when he isn't reminiscing, fondly, about the shanty town of his distant youth, or grumbling about the new crop of up-and-comers who have commandeered the early 19th century homes, installing solar panels, hot tubs, stainless steel, and granite. "The whole neighborhood is a construction zone," he frequently complains to Lucinda. "A man can't even drive down his own street because of all the contractors' trucks parked all over the place." Neil bristled when his elderly next-door neighbors put their home on the market last fall. Tonight, after emerging from the subway and covering the short distance to Neil's house, Lucinda notes the for sale sign has disappeared from the adjacent lawn. Either the place sold, or the neighbors changed their minds about moving. For Neil's sake, she hopes for the latter. A bracing wind stirs the tree branches overhead, heavy with the scent of wood smoke wafting from the Bullard's brick chimney and most of the others in the neighborhood. Shivering and hugging the scrapbook against her chest, Lucinda remembers why she's here. The same ripple of fear that had her constantly looking over her shoulder on the way over causes her to keep a furtive eye on the shadowy shrub border as she hurries to the front door of Neil's modest two-story home. A total stranger answers the door. "Oops." "I'm sorry." Lucinda steps back to look up at the house number, illuminated in the glow of the porch light. "I must have the wrong house. I was looking for..."
"The Bullards? You're in the right place."
The man, balding, graying, somewhere around retirement age, wearing denim overalls, holds the door open for her.
"Come on in. You must be Lucinda."
"Yes." And he must be... She really has no clue.
"I'm Garland Fisher," he explains, shaking her gloved hand. "I just moved in next door."
"Oh, it's nice to meet you."
"You too. Say, that's some moon up there, isn't it?"
She looks over her shoulder to briefly admire, beyond the bare tree branches, the fat white orb hanging low in the sky. Just like in the movie Moonstruck, she finds herself thinking, the memory triggered by that DVD that mistakenly arrived earlier. Though tonight's moon, in its waning phase, looks as though someone sliced a crescent from its curved surface.
"Neil's trying to get the grandkids into their pajamas,"
his neighbor informs her as she steps over the threshold.
"Said for me to tell you that he'll be right down, and for you to make yourself at home. Told me to do the same thing when I popped over a few minutes ago, but really, I just need to borrow a wrench. Got a leaky faucet in the kitchen. Old houses. You know how it goes."
She does. But how does he know that? Of course, there's no hidden meaning in his words, no hint of a knowing expression in his pale blue eyes as they gaze at her from behind a pair of wire-rimmed bifocals. He's just a nice man, making conversation. Nothing more. He certainly didn't break into Lucinda's apartment while she was away, tamper with her own leaky faucet, and leave behind a scrapbook filled with dead women.
Of course not. Was out all day, and walked in a little while ago to find my sink full of water, he confides, plopping himself down on the couch in the Bullards' familiar gold wallpapered living room. Familiar to Lucinda, that is. She can't help but notice that newcomer Garland Fisher really is making himself right at home amid the family photos and 1970s-era furniture, with the air of one who belongs. All my tools are still packed. Just moved in last week, and darned if I didn't open half a dozen boxes looking for a wrench before I decided it would be easier to just borrow one. But it looks like poor Neil has his hands full with those kids. Sounds like it, too, he adds, casting a glance at the ceiling as running footsteps scamper overhead. I'm sure he does. Got a couple of grandkids myself, he confides. They live with my son and daughter-in-law out in California.
Is that where you moved from?
Oh, no, lived in Philadelphia all my life.
Watching Garland Fisher cross his legs and drape an arm along the back of the couch atop Irma's homemade doilies, she again notes that he's a little too comfortable here for someone who's so new to the neighborhood.
Lost my wife last spring, he adds. She was just 66. We were high school sweethearts, had been together forever.
I'm so sorry, he nods.
Couldn't stand living in our house without her. People say a widower shouldn't make a move for at least a year, but me, I've always thought a change of scenery is good for the soul. Helps you heal. So here I am. New house, new neighborhood, maybe even new career. Always wanted to be a writer, and now I've got a couple of stories accepted by a magazine.
Really? Congratulations. Which magazine?
You probably never heard of it. One of those literary short story publications. Pays in copies, not cash. But hey, my name and my work will be in print. That's what counts, right?
Absolutely, she agrees, discarding her paranoia in favor of the theory that he's simply an exceedingly affable, harmless, lonely old guy. Mentioning a leaky faucet and a wrench wasn't a veiled message that he was behind the album in her hands. That's ridiculous. Although when his eyes flick down at it, held stiffly on her lap in her gloved hands, she finds herself growing tense all over again.
That a photo album? He asks.
Technically, it isn't, but she nods anyway and fights the urge to put it behind her back.
Come over to show Neil some pictures, did you?
Footsteps pounding down the stairs save her having to reply. Neil's twin red-headed, freckled grandchildren, Maeve and Sean, skid into the room wearing footy pajamas.
Hi, Lucinda,
Sean, whom his grandfather calls a shameless little flirt, looks thrilled to see her.
Guess what? I lost my front teeth.
I see that. Very cool. He grins broadly, then hollers,
Poppy, Lucinda's here.
Maeve has already busied herself over by the fireplace, picking up a poker and jabbing it into the dying embers beyond the folding glass door and screen.
Whoa there, I don't think that's a good idea, young lady.
Garland, surprisingly spry, is on his feet and taking the poker out of the child's hand before Lucinda even realizes what she was up to.
No, I want that. It's mine,
Maeve protests, grabbing at the poker. Garland staunchly holds it out of her reach. Sean looks at Lucinda.
Want to know a secret Maeve told me? The tooth fairy isn't real.
Lucinda shakes her head. Maeve, guess what? A secret isn't a secret unless only one person knows it.
Ah, truer words have never been spoken.
Lucinda looks up to see Neil in the doorway. As always, she's momentarily taken aback at the sight of him in casual clothes, a flannel shirt, jeans, and suede slippers. What's left of his salt and pepper hair tufts on the crown of his head, probably courtesy of a child's playful fingers, and his green eyes, deeply set beneath bushy white brows and a weathered face, are tired.
Maeve, you stop that,
he scolds, and takes the poker from Garland's grasp.
I'm a cowgirl. I have to cook my supper over the fire.
You already ate your supper, cowgirl, and fires are dangerous.
Neil sets the poker in the wrought iron stand on the tile hearth, then glances over at Lucinda.
I hate to bother you when you have your family here, Neil. I didn't know they were coming this weekend.
Neither did I. Irma and I went to visit them in Scranton Saturday, and Patty and the kids decided to ride back with us for a few days. Then tonight, Irma decided they needed some mother-daughter time, so they went out to dinner and left the kids with me.
Even the baby?
Not the baby. Her, they took with them. Why not? She doesn't do anything but sleep, eat, and crap. But these twins are a handful lately.
Where's Jeff?
Back in Scranton, on ER duty all weekend.
Neil turns his attention to his new neighbor.
I'll go to the basement now and grab that wrench you wanted, Garland. Sorry about the wait. No rush. Take your time. After that, Maeve and Sean, you two can sit here and watch Noggin and keep yourselves out of trouble while I talk to Lucinda in the other room.
Even as he says it, he glances worriedly at the fireplace.
Don't think that's a good idea,
Garland voices the thought on Lucinda's mind, and probably on Neil's as well.
All right, then Lucinda and I will talk in here, and you two kids will go wait in the kitchen.
Right. With the stove and the knife block and all kinds of food they can choke on, Lucinda opens her mouth to tell Neil she'll just catch up with him tomorrow, but Garland speaks first.
Neil, how about if I sit here and watch TV with the kids while you and your friend go talk in the kitchen? You don't have to. What else have I got to do?
Garland shrugs.
My leaky sink can wait. When you're done with your visit, I'll take the wrench and be on my way. Thanks, Garland.
Lucinda follows Neil to the kitchen, past a glass cabinet that holds Irma's collection of willow tree figurines, a table cluttered with little wooden cat's meows, and a shelf lined with thimbles from around the world. Not that Irma's been any of those places. She asks friends to bring them back to her. Neil is always grumbling about Irma's many collections, but Lucinda notices that he seems to enjoy adding to at least one of them on every gift-giving occasion. Just last week on Valentine's Day, he'd shown Lucinda a silver bracelet dangling with dragonfly charms he'd bought for Irma, who, of course, collects dragonfly jewelry, pins, earrings, pendants. The Bullards' affectionate marriage is so different from her own parents. The only thing her mother collects is designer handbags, and every time Dad buys her one, Lucinda suspects, he also buys one for his longtime mistress. Neil kicks the swinging kitchen door shut behind them.
Sorry about the mess in here.
It's not so bad.
Irma ordinarily keeps a neat house, but the remnants of supper, and perhaps lunch, too, are on the countertops and sink. Crumbs litter the floor. Several apple magnets have fallen off the fridge door. Irma collects apples. The throw rug in front of the stove is askew, and one of the blue gingham check curtains that frame the back door window is missing a tie-back.
Want some tea?
Neil asks, turning on the flame beneath the copper kettle on the stove.
I'm making some for myself.
Thanks. We should make this quick, though, so that your neighbor can be on his way.
I just hope we don't go back into the living room and find him roped to a chair with a fire burning in his feet.
She can't help but grin at that.
The kids aren't so bad.
No, they're just creative, with active imaginations. That's what Irma keeps telling me. Good thing Mr. Fisher hasn't been hanging around here all day, or he wouldn't have offered to keep an eye on them.
He's a nice man.
Seems that way. Little too folksy for me, though.
Neil adds in a whisper, and she can't help but smile. Folksy about sums up Garland Fisher, from the overalls to his pronoun-dropping speech pattern. Folksy and harmless.
Have a seat and I'll be right back. I want to go grab that wrench from my toolbox before I forget.
Neil disappears through a doorway and down the stairs into the basement. Lucinda sits at the table. She's shared many meals here with Neil and Irma, a motherly homebody with an innate need to feed people. Quite the opposite of the fashionably skeletal Bitsy Sloane, who exists mainly on lemon water and watercress, and believes others should do the same. Back from the basement, Neil puts the wrench on the counter beside an open loaf of Wonder Bread and jar of peanut butter, then sits opposite Lucinda.
"Let me see what you have there."
He gestures at the scrapbook. Lucinda lays it carefully on the kitchen table between them. "I found this on my bed when I got home. I was away this weekend, remember?"
"With that guy, Jimmy," he nods. "Someone broke in while you were gone and left this?"
"Well, I don't know that they broke in. I mean, the door was locked, so..." She pauses, hearing running footsteps and giggling. Uh-oh, the kids are on the move. Neil ignores it, focused on the matter at hand.
"So someone has a duplicate key."
"It looks that way. Or maybe they came in a window. Some of them don't have locks, and there aren't any bars or anything. And, well, the thing is, I didn't have the door locks changed either when I moved in," she admits and waits for him to scold her.
"Lucinda, don't tell me that after all these years of living in the city, you..."
"I know, I know. I'll talk to Peggy tomorrow."
"Who's Peggy?"
"The super."
"A woman super?"
"Yes, and we can vote, too." She opens the scrapbook. "I want to show you..." She breaks off at the sound of a loud crash somewhere at the front of the house.
"What the devil?"
Neil bolts from the kitchen, with Lucinda on his heels. A shattered vase lies on the floor beside a table in the front hall. Garland and Sean are on the stairway, peering over the banister. Seeing them, Neil asks,
"Where's Maeve?"
"Don't know. She kept asking if we could play hide and seek. Told her no, we were watching TV, and the next thing I knew, she was gone. Sean and I were just looking for her." "Maeve, where are you?"
"I didn't do it, Poppy," a small voice announces, and Lucinda spots Neil's granddaughter peeking around the doorway in the living room. She looks so traumatized that Neil's expression immediately softens.
"It's okay, Maeve, it was an accident."
"But I didn't break it. The man did." They all look at Garland.
"You did me a favor," Neil says. "I never liked that vase, and Irma has so many knick-knacks around here that you can't make a move without..."
"Not that man."
"Wasn't me."
Simultaneously interrupted by both Maeve and Garland, Neil breaks off, confused, looking from one to the other.
"The other man did it, Poppy,"
Maeve explains, still half-hidden, almost cowering behind the doorframe.
"Which man?"
"He was scary. I was hiding over there."
She points at the corner behind a coat tree draped in winter garments.
"He didn't see me."
"Who?"
"The scary man," she says impatiently.
"What scary man?"
"The one who opened the door. He knocked the vase off the table and then he closed the door."
Neil looks at Lucinda.
"Active imagination is right," he mutters, and she smiles sympathetically at both him and Maeve.
When Lucinda was young, she herself was often accused by her family of having an active imagination. That's what you get when you see things nobody else can see, and know things you can't possibly know. Lucinda is pretty sure Maeve isn't a budding psychic, but she feels a kinship to the child nonetheless. Neil goes over to Maeve and crouches beside her.
"I don't mind that you broke the vase, but I do mind that you're lying about it."
"Lying is bad," Sean announces from the stairway above. "Mom says liars don't get dessert."
"I'm not a liar, Sean."
"You are too."
"I am not."
Lucinda begins picking up the shards of broken pottery as Neil referees and Garland surveys the situation, probably grateful that his own grandchildren live across the continent. During the first lull, he clears his throat and announces,
"Really should get going."
"Oh, Garland." Crouched beside a frustrated Maeve, Neil looks apologetically up at his neighbor.
"I'm sorry I left the wrench on the counter in the kitchen. Go ahead and grab it." "Thanks, Neil. I'll let myself out the back door, then."
He
He takes a down jacket from the coat tree, shrugs into it, and pulls on a knit navy blue ski cap and matching gloves.
Nice meeting you, Lucinda.
You too. She waves with a hand that isn't full of broken shards. Neil goes back to trying to reason with the kids as Garland disappears into the kitchen. A moment later, Lucinda hears the back door open, then close behind him. Neil gives up on trying to reason with Maeve, who is still insisting she didn't lie, and Sean, who is still insisting he's going to tell their mother. He sends the kids back into the living room and noggin, then turns to Lucinda, still picking up pieces of the vase.
I'll get that, Sin. You'll cut yourself.
It's fine, I've got it. Lucky thing I never took my gloves off, see? He nods.
We'll take that photo album to be dusted for fingerprints tomorrow.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'll have to wait until afternoon, though. I have to drive Patty and the kids back to Scranton.
And none too soon, she suspects. Do you really think they'll find any prints? Any that match anything in the database, I mean? Neil shoots from the hip, as always.
Hell no, but you know we have to check.
I know. Lucinda straightens and heads toward the kitchen with the broken pottery, suddenly exhausted. She isn't eager to head back home to her apartment after what happened, but what choice does she have? As if he's read her mind, Neil falls into step behind her, saying,
Stay here tonight with us, Sin.
For the briefest moment, she entertains the possibility. No, she tells him. I can't. You already have a house full. And anyway, I have to go back there sooner or later.
You can't be sure it's safe.
This time I'll lock the windows, and I'll chain the door. After, she checks under the bed and in the closets again, just to be sure she's alone.
Wait for Irma, at least, so that I can come back with you and check things out.
Again, she shakes her head. Tempting as the offer is, she can't let herself take him up on it. He's been through enough tonight, and he has a long round-trip drive ahead of him tomorrow. I really want to get home to bed, she tells him. I'll take the album with me. Call me when you... She breaks off, staring at the kitchen table. The scrapbook is gone. On the table, in its place, is a piece of paper. Stepping closer, Lucinda sees that it reads 74.2, 39.6. That's it. Just a pair of decimal numbers, one on top of the other, in the center of the page.
But why would Garland have stolen the scrapbook?
Neil asks Lucinda, shaking his head as he hands her a mug of strong, hot Irish tea.
It doesn't make sense.
I know it doesn't. All I'm saying is that he walked through the kitchen on his way out the door. No one else was in here, and we would have noticed if one of the kids had left the room.
Possibly.
Probably. Neil shrugs and sits across from her, sipping his own tea. Lucinda has never been a big believer in circumstantial evidence. Too many times, her own intuition has led her to look beyond the obvious, with fruitful results. Too bad her intuitive gifts seem clouded by her own involvement in this case. Aside from having sensed something wrong when she walked into her apartment earlier, she hasn't had any psychic impressions of who left the book in her apartment, or why someone stole it away again and left the cryptic message in its place.
I still think the sheet of paper fell out of the scrapbook when you put it on the table,
Neil tells her. But I went through it a couple of times, and I never saw it.
Maybe you missed it.
Maybe she did. But if it had fallen from the album's pages, it might have landed upside down or on the floor. The way it was found, lying face up, margins almost precisely perpendicular to the edge of the table, makes it seem far more likely that someone deliberately placed it there.
Why don't you tell me what was in it before we jump to any more conclusions?
There were articles and pictures of several young women who died years ago. They were all college students, and they all committed suicide, supposedly.
Supposedly.
Right. Ava Neary was one of them. Camden Hastings' sister, remember?
Yes, you were all over television talking about that case.
Don't remind me, she sighs. I was trying to help. I thought maybe somebody who knew something would see it and come forward.
Looks to me like somebody did.
Neil's face, creased with age yet still handsome, is grim.
I don't like this.
You're not the only one.
So the scrapbook was filled with newspaper articles?
Not original clippings. They were photocopies. Someone probably made them from a microfiche of the old newspaper pages, or printed them off the internet.
All suicides are initially investigated as homicides, Sin. You know that, right?
I do. But the cops investigating them didn't have the big picture. They're all isolated cases, handled by local police in 7 different jurisdictions. It doesn't look like anyone even connected the victims, other than in this scrapbook.
It was a lot easier to miss patterns in the days before computers, and to miss signs of foul play. Forensics back then might as well have been non-existent compared to what we have today.
I know. And there were similarities in these cases that might have raised a red flag if anyone had connected them.
Like?
Like all of the women were young and pretty, with long, straight hair parted in the middle.
It was the early 70s, right? That's what everyone looked like.
They all used particularly violent means to kill themselves. One drove her car off a cliff. A couple of them hung themselves. Some jumped to their deaths. One even shot herself in the mouth.
That's unusual. Men tend to kill themselves using violent means, not women. Women swallow pills, shut themselves in a garage with the motor running, that sort of thing. There are exceptions, but...
He shakes his head. Exactly. And in every one of those reports, if you look at the quotes from the people who knew the victims, nobody around these girls saw it coming. The suicides happened out of the blue. Some of them left notes, but they were typewritten.
Isn't that a surprise?
Neil, if the same person who killed Ava Neary killed the rest of them? Neil nods.
We might have a serial killer on our hands.
Well, we don't. I mean, this all happened decades ago, but it does seem like someone wants us, me, to tie it all together.
Let's just hope whoever managed to get into your apartment didn't play an active role in any of it.
I doubt it. Why would the killer want someone to solve the murders?
Some serial offenders leave clues or even communicate with the authorities, as if they consciously or subconsciously want to be caught. But that's usually not really the case. More likely what they want is attention, even anonymous attention. They're starring in their own scripted drama.
More like pulling the strings in a puppet show.
Exactly. They want to demonstrate that they're in control. That's what it's all about. Control. Power. They'll tease the authorities into coming close, dangerously, oh so close, and then slip away again to show who's in charge.
But I'm not the authorities, Lucinda thinks. And anyway, 40 years have passed since the first so-called suicide was committed. Hearing from the killer now doesn't fit a typical pattern, does it? Maybe it wasn't the killer who left me this scrapbook, Neil. Maybe one of the victim's family members saw me on television and wanted me to know that Ava wasn't the only one.
I don't buy it. Even if the person wanted to remain anonymous, he could have just called the police hotline number.
Seeing all those women together in a scrapbook was pretty powerful stuff, though.
Then why not mail it to you?
I don't know.
I do. Someone wanted to scare the hell out of you, Sin.
Well, they didn't succeed. Neil just looks at her. All right, maybe they succeeded just a little. She sips her tea, hating that this happened to her, hating that she's scared.
How much do you know about this guy Jimmy you've been seeing?
Startled by Neil's abrupt question, she considers it, and realizes it's one that's been in the back of her own mind ever since she found the album on her bed. For one thing, I'm not seeing him anymore.
I thought you'd just...
I told him tonight, when we got back, that it's not going to work out.
That's good. I wasn't crazy about him.
No way. Really? She smiles faintly, but only for a moment. You don't think he did this, do you?
Neil throws up his hands. After all these years in this business, Sin, I wouldn't put anything past anyone. You know that.
Jimmy was with me all weekend, though. He picked me up Friday night to take me to the airport, and he brought me home again tonight.
Okay, so you had your eyes on him the whole time he was in your place?
Tonight, yes. The other night...
The other night what?
She shakes her head. I'm not sure. We were running late for the flight, and I was making sure I had my passport and watering the plants and all that last-minute stuff. He was in my room because he carried my bag, and that's where I had it. But I just wasn't paying attention. I can't remember if I was in there after he was or not.
So if he was the last one out of your bedroom, he could have left the album on your bed.
He could have. But it would have been pretty damned risky, don't you think?
You know as well as I do that some people, dangerous people, thrive on the thrill of taking risks.
Jimmy isn't one of them, trust me. But how can you be sure? You only know what he's told you, what he's shown you. You've never even met anyone else in his life, never seen his kids or heard them call him while you were with him, never seen where he works or lives. How do you know any of it is true?
Just be careful around him, Sin, if he tries to get in touch again.
I will. The mere thought that Jimmy could possibly be behind this, as a prank or something more sinister, is far more disturbing to her than she lets on to Neil. She's always been a good judge of character. Goes with the territory when you're a psychic. She's reasonably sure Jimmy didn't do it. But not 100% sure, are you? Lucinda has never had much trouble falling asleep, despite all her nervous energy, or perhaps because of it. Most nights she falls into bed exhausted and is typically out cold within minutes of hitting the pillow. Not tonight. She can't stop thinking about the missing scrapbook. She has no idea what the numbers mean, but one thing is clear. Lucinda is being followed, watched. That alone is enough to keep her awake into the wee hours. Not that she fears a stranger is lurking in the apartment with her now. She examined every inch of the apartment when she got back here, holding her BlackBerry with a worried Neil connected on the other end of the phone line. No boogeyman, she assured him before hanging up, forcing an upbeat tone into her voice. She's pretty sure Neil didn't buy it, because he asked her one last time if she was sure she wanted to spend the night here alone. I'm absolutely positive, Neil. And she absolutely was. Still is. This is, quite simply, how she operates. Lucinda Sloan doesn't run scared, and she doesn't rely on other people to bail her out of tough situations. Where would she be if she did that? Back on the main line, living off her parents' money, and under their thumbs. No, thank you. She's been taking care of herself ever since the day she moved out of their stone mansion for the last time, after years of coming and going from boarding schools and college dorms. Whatever is going on here, she'll handle. Even if I am secretly scared shitless and have to sleep with the light on. She rolls onto her back and stares at the cracks in the plaster ceiling, once again going over every detail. One thing keeps nagging at her. Maeve's comment about a man breaking the vase. There's no doubt that the child has an active imagination. But what if she was telling the truth? He smiles as he leafs through the scrapbook, this time with bare fingers chapped blotchy red from the relentless cold. He had forgotten, over all those insulated years in prison, how harsh the elements can be. Had forgotten how wind off the water can slice like a knife, can rub raw the skin over joints until it splits and bleeds. Maybe he should wear gloves more often, not just to prevent leaving fingerprints. No need to worry about that now that the scrapbook is back in his possession, though. No need to worry about anything from here on in. Things have fallen into place like clockwork in the past couple of days. Clockwork. His grin broadens at his own cleverness. What did she make of his first little clue? The numbers. Could she possibly have figured out what they mean? No. But she will. Soon enough. And soon enough, she'll discover the second clue he left her. Not tonight, though. First thing tomorrow morning. He'd bet his life on that. He's been watching her long enough to know she's a creature of habit. Standing abruptly, he carries the scrapbook over to the hearth. After moving the screen aside, he jabs at the logs with a wrought iron poker, stirring the red-hot embers back to life, enjoying the crackling sound. When the blaze is good and ready, he opens the book one last time to the page that shows Ava Neary's photo. "Thank you, sweetheart," he softly tells her. Then he tosses the scrapbook onto the fire and watches the ferocious flames lick her smiling, unsuspecting face. Chapter 3. On this dismal winter morning, there's no real sunrise. The rectangles of sky beyond Lucinda's bedroom windows simply go from black to charcoal, and finally to a sodden gray, signaling that it's safe for her to turn off the bedside lamp. Feeling as though someone took a loofah to her eyelids, she gets out of bed and laces her fingers at the nape of her neck, stretching. Her entire body aches with tension, but sleep is a lost cause. She dozed off at some point in the night, but not for long, and it was a restless sleep marred by a reoccurring dream she's had lately. In the dream, she's always working a big wooden jigsaw puzzle. It's almost done, but for some reason, she can't tell what it's supposed to be. The picture has worn off the box. She fits one piece after another until she gets to the end and realizes one piece is missing. She looks everywhere for it, but it's nowhere to be found, and without it, she can't tell what the picture is. It makes no sense, of course. One missing piece wouldn't make a puzzle picture ambiguous, but dreams have little logic. Unless she finds the missing piece, all her work has been for nothing, because the puzzle has no meaning. Whenever she wakes from this particular dream, she feels exhausted, though today she'd probably feel that way regardless. Grateful for the light of dawn, dim as it is, Lucinda goes into the bathroom to brush her teeth. Her reflection in the medicine cabinet mirror catches her off guard. The fluorescent lighting is harsh, emphasizing the dark circles beneath her eyes and the haunted expression in them. She quickly opens the mirrored door to get the toothpaste and leaves it open as she brushes her teeth and splashes water on her face, not wanting to look at herself. An immediate caffeine fix is in order. She goes to the kitchen, opens the fridge, grabs a can of Pepsi and chugs some. Not exactly the breakfast of champions, but the sweet fizz is just what she needs first thing every morning, particularly this morning. When she ordered it for breakfast the first morning in Curacao, Jimmy looked at her as though she'd just asked the waiter to score her some heroin.
Pepsi? At this hour?
We're in a different time zone.
Yeah, an hour ahead of Philly.
Whatever. I drink Pepsi for breakfast. Sue me. That was the first time she wished she were back in the slushy, muddy Northeast, but it wasn't the last. Remembering what Neil said last night about Jimmy, she decides it's a very good thing she impulsively broke it off last night. Just in case. Just in case he happened to have killed Ava Neary and a bunch of other innocent girls back in the 60s and 70s? That's hardly likely. How old can he be? A couple of decades older than she is, but he's been pretty vague about his age. For all she knows, he was 12 when Ava was killed. Or maybe he was 20, around Ava's age. Troubled, Lucinda takes a stack of fluted white paper filters from the cupboard and separates one. Wishing Cam weren't skiing somewhere out west, where it's still the middle of the night, Lucinda is planning to call her cell phone later. Cam should be told about the scrapbook. Told. Warned. Just in case someone has been prowling around her as well. At least she's safely out of town for the time being. As Lucinda fits the filter into the black plastic basket, she tries, as she's been doing all night, to remember the details about some of the women who appeared in the scrapbook before it was snatched away. She clearly recalls two of the victims' entire names. One is Sandra Wuppner. The girl bore an incredible resemblance to Ava, even more so than the others. Lucinda read her story with particular interest. Sandra Wuppner hung herself while she was babysitting for a little girl who found her body. The child's mother told the police her daughter said Sandra's boyfriend had been over that night, which he later denied, even providing an alibi. Lucinda can't remember his name or that of the family for whom Sandra had been babysitting, but she's pretty sure it was Italian, and she's positive Sandra Wuppner lived and died in Buffalo. The other memorable so-called suicide victim was Elizabeth Johnson. Lucinda had known an Elizabeth Johnston back in boarding school. When she was skimming the scrapbook, the name jumped out at her, and she did a double take before seeing that it was Johnson, no T. Common name. She can just imagine how many hits she'd find on a search engine. At least she knows that this Elizabeth, like her old friend, was also from suburban New York City. Westchester, maybe, or Connecticut. She wishes she could remember where, but she can't. One of the shore towns? Rye? Darien? Where was it? Yawning deeply, she measures coffee grounds into the filter basket. Instead of making half a pot, all of which she drinks herself on an ordinary morning, she decides to go for the full 12 cups. She'll need it. About to fill the glass carafe at the tap, she notices something inside, resting on the bottom. Frowning, she opens the lid. What on earth? It's a ring. She pulls it out to examine it. A signet ring, engraved with an elaborately swirled letter Z, and caked with something dried and brown. As Lucinda holds it, a vision sweeps her thoughts. A woman. She's lying on a tile floor in a pool of blood, face frozen in terror. Familiar face. Eyes wide open. Familiar blue eyes. As quickly as it came over her, the vision disappears. Gripping the edge of the sink, Lucinda realizes she's just seen the corpse of Randy Barricat's wife, Carla. Cam gently settles the pink-wrapped bundle into the cradle. There, she barely whispers. Go back to sleep now. It's early. She touches her baby's face to make sure the fever hasn't come back. No, she's over the worst of it. Her first cold. Cam tiptoes into the hall and closes the door to the baby's room, right next door to Tessa's room. If only little Grace would sleep as soundly as her big sister does. Teenagers, Cam knows, are biologically disposed to sleeping in. But 12:30, which is what time Tess came downstairs yesterday, is a little extreme, even for a weekend. Of course, Tess was then up until all hours last night, rattling noisily around the house and waking the baby after her midnight feeding. As a result, Cam threatened to wake Tess at the crack of dawn today, if only to ensure that she'll be good and tired tonight. Then again, it's nice to have the house quiet, all to herself, for a change. Maybe she'll let Tess sleep just a little longer. Cam pads back downstairs in her robe and slippers and wonders whether to bother making a pot of coffee. She got out of the habit for all those months when she was pregnant and she and Mike were separated, and got back into it when he moved back home, especially after the baby came. Grace is a fussy baby, and a light sleeper, snoozing only for a few hours at a time, even now that she's over 3 months old. The pediatrician said she's no longer waking in the night because she's hungry, but Cam isn't about to let her lie there and cry. So she continues to get up around the clock, and whenever she does, she feeds her daughter, because the baby always takes it, and maybe the doctor is wrong. Standing in her big, beautiful kitchen, stainless and granite and custom cherry cabinetry, all appreciated daily and a far cry from the dingy apartments where she was raised by a single father, Cam yawns deeply and surveys the coffee maker. It seems like so much trouble to brew a whole pot just for one person. Mike is away, skiing in Utah with his parents, brothers, and their families. Cam and the girls were supposed to go with them, but then Grace got sick, and the pediatrician thought the plane trip might be painful for her ears with all the congestion. Tess, who ordinarily would have jumped at the chance to go skiing, jumped instead at the chance to stay home and help. Cam has no illusion there. Her daughter wasn't looking forward to being away from her boyfriend for a week. Now she doesn't have to. Mike, too, would have stayed behind, but Cam wouldn't let him. How could she? His family's annual February family trip was, last year, the bone of contention that ultimately triggered their marital separation. Trouble had been simmering for years, though. A bitter brew of resentment, secrets, and booze. Cam drank to block out the visions that had tormented her since childhood. Visions of people, mostly kids, in danger. She didn't dare tell anyone, not even Mike, afraid he would decide she was nuts, just like her mother had been, and that he would leave her, just like her mother had done. It had been hard enough for Mike to defy his father's expectations and marry a girl like her in the first place. Staying in the marriage, despite Cam's drinking and the labyrinth she'd constructed to protect her secret, wasn't easy for him. Now the walls have come down, and she hasn't had a drop of liquor in almost a year. And although the troubling visions continue to pop up, she deals with them, with Mike's support and understanding. Her marriage is back on track. Not perfect, not easy, but working for them both. Much, Cam assumes, to her father-in-law's dismay. Mike's father has never liked Cam. Never liked anyone, really, as far as she can tell. But her family background made her lower than low on his list. Michael Hastings Sr. was hardly thrilled when his son married a Jersey girl with a hard-living bar-band rocker for a father and a mother who had disappeared onto the streets of Camden, New Jersey, when her younger daughter was barely out of diapers. Last summer, Cam found out what happened to her mother after she left them. Now she knows where Brenda Neary lived and where she died. But the nagging questions about what had happened to Cam's mother were almost immediately replaced with more disturbing questions about her sister. Revisiting Ava's death after all these years in such a troubling manner came completely out of left field. But Cam doesn't doubt Lucinda Sloane's claim that her beautiful, capable older sister, who had everything to live for and who promised never to leave Cam after their mother did, didn't really kill herself. She does believe that Ava was murdered. Difficult as it was to face the media spotlight in the wake of Tess's encounter with a homicidal lunatic last summer, Cam was hopeful that it might lead to the truth about Ava, that somebody, somewhere, would recognize her picture on television, that Ava's fate, too, would be laid to rest. They did hear from a couple of people who had known Ava at NYU. Cam and Lucinda had spoken to all of them. While they expressed how shocked they had been by her suicide, no one had solid information indicating that it had been anything else. There were false leads, too. More than a few crackpots came out of the woodwork. Now, months later, there has been nothing at all. After getting her hopes up, Cam has come to accept that she'll probably never find out who was responsible for her sister's death. She's grateful to know, at least, that it wasn't Ava herself, that Ava hadn't broken her promise never to leave Cam. Not like her mother. not like her father, Ike, who did his best to raise her, but who was more attached to the band and the bottle than he was to being a dad. Not like Mike. You have some serious abandonment issues, her marriage therapist told her in a recent session. Everyone you've ever depended on has left you at one time or another. Even Mike. Of course, he came back, and they're in a good place now, better than ever before. But there will always be a nagging fear in the back of Cam's mind that everything they have could disappear tomorrow. You can't think that way, Mike told her when, in a counseling session, she confessed the persistent shred of misgiving. I can't help it. People come and go, sometimes by choice and sometimes not. She was remembering how close they had come to losing Tess. You can't guarantee that you'll be here forever, Mike. If it's up to me, I will be. But it might not always be up to him. Life is precarious. You can't know what lies in the future, or even right around the corner. Ironic for a psychic to have come to that realization. So, really, all Cam can do when it comes to the people she loves, all anyone can do, is hold on tight and hope. But when it comes to Ava, maybe all she can do is let go. Had it been a decent hour when his cell phone rang, Randy might have recognized the Philadelphia area code on caller ID and had the presence of mind to ignore it. Instead, groggy with sleep, he finds himself answering it. Randy, it's Lucinda. The sound of her voice catches him off guard. Or maybe it's not her voice as much as his own reaction to it, even after all these years. Years? It's been mere months since he last spoke to her. He called just before Thanksgiving, ostensibly to see whether she'd had any news on the Ava Neary case. She hadn't, of course. She'd have let him know if there had been any new developments, wouldn't she? Maybe not. Maybe she had concluded, as he initially had, that they were better off keeping a safe distance from each other. How many times did they attempt that in the old days before falling into each other's arms again? It was Neil who pointed out the obvious back then. Neil who had pretended to look the other way for so long. Neil who rarely said much of anything that wasn't directly related to their police work. Long married, fiercely devoted family man, Neil. You have to go, he told Randy one day. Man of few words. 1 minute they were discussing a case. Or rather, Neil was talking, and Randy was pretending to listen while watching Lucinda through the glass window of Neil's office. Go where? Randy figured he'd missed something, that Neil wanted him to go investigate some detail of the crime. Away. For good. What are you talking about? You have to go. Because of her. Neil, back to the window, jerked his thumb in Lucinda's direction. Neil was right. If Randy couldn't have her, he couldn't be near her. He had to move on. And he had tried. For years. When he called Lucinda that cold November day, he'd been planning to feel her out, maybe to suggest that they see each other so that she could fill him in on the case, and he could fill her in on his own life. But she rushed him off the phone, saying she was on her way to see Cam and Mike's new baby. Ever since, amid all that's been going on, he's been waiting for the right time to reconnect. He never expected Lucinda to beat him to it. Hey, what's up? How are you? He asks, trying to sound casual. There's a pause on the other end of the line. Is Carla there with you? She knows, he realizes. That's why she's calling. Or does she? How would she? His heart pounds. No. Are you at home? He hesitates. No, he says again. She is, though. I'm in Tahoe, skiing. I came out for the long weekend with a couple of buddies.
Silence on the other end of the line. When was the last time you talked to her?
Oh, hell. He doesn't really want to do this right now. Not from here. Not like this.
Last night, he lies.
Why?
She ignores the question, asking another of her own.
When are you going back home?
Never.
In a couple of days?
Randy, she knows he's lying. She knows the truth. Why else would she be asking these pointed questions?
Yeah?
He holds his breath, waiting. But the confrontation doesn't come. She says only, I'll let you get back to your skiing.
Lucinda, it's 5 in the morning here. I'm not skiing.
Oh, right. I'll let you get back to sleep then. I never would have called if I had known you were in a different time zone. Sorry, Randy.
No worries.
No worries? Where did that come from? He's never used that phrase in his life.
He's noticed Californians say it all the time, though.
And you are in California, he reminds himself.
Never mind that no worries hardly describes his current frame of mind.
Let Lucinda think he's having a good old time in his rented Tahoe chalet and hanging out on the slopes.
For now, anyway.
Sooner or later, she'll learn the truth.
Restless, Cam moves around the kitchen, making coffee after all. Her gaze falls on a stack of mail on the counter, unopened for at least a couple of days, probably since Mike left on Friday. She had forgotten, in 15 years, how chaotic it can be to have a newborn in the house, how the most mundane things, opening mail, unloading the dishwasher, returning phone calls, can be neglected for days on end. After pouring water into the coffee maker and pressing start, she sits at the table, determined to at least sort the pile so that she can weed the junk, credit card offers, catalogs, from the real mail, which in this age of electronic correspondence will all be bills, of course. Bill, bill, bill. Ah, something that's neither a bill nor, as far as she can tell, junk. The envelope is postmarked in New York City and affixed with a typed white address label that, oddly, bears her name. Her whole name. Camden Neary Hastings. That's the odd part, the Neary. Most people in her life these days don't know her maiden name. Those who were in her life back in the old days when she used it have long since drifted away. Frowning, she turns the envelope over, looking for a return address. There isn't one. When she opens it, she finds out why. Lucinda had been so sure she'd find Randy at home with Carla that her vision had been a terrible mistake. Or had she? Come on, Lucinda. There's a ring in your coffee pot, for God's sake. A ring in her coffee pot and a corpse in her mind, as vivid as if she'd stumbled across it in person. Never in her life has her sixth sense shown her a dead person who wasn't already dead, or soon to be. Why would you think that might have changed now? She knows the answer to her own question. When she'd first seen Ava Neary being pushed from that rooftop in a vision, she had mistaken her for Cam's daughter, Tess. Then Tess went missing, and Lucinda knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that there would be no happy ending. But there was. Maybe there will be again. But what are the odds that Carla Carnicky Barracat has a look-alike who happens to have been murdered on a bathroom floor somewhere? Her head spinning, Lucinda looks at the signet ring. Where did it come from? And what is that brown stuff on it? Could it possibly be blood? But it can't be Carla's ring, can it? Not with the initial Z on it. Neil. I have to call Neil. He's still got the grandkids today and that long round-trip drive to Scranton, and it's still so early. Bradley. He'll be up. He He'll know what to do. She quickly speed dials his cell phone from her BlackBerry, noticing, as she does, that her battery is down to one bar. She forgot to charge it last night. The phone rings a few times, then goes into voicemail.
You've reached Bradley Carmichael. Please leave a message and I'll call you back.
Damn it. He's probably on a treadmill or something.
Bradley, it's Lucinda. Call me.
She knows he checks his voicemail religiously. An aging musical theater actor, he's been out of work since before the holidays, other than a department store Santa gig. For years, he performed on Broadway. He loves to share anecdotes about the hit musicals he's been in. My Fair Lady, Guys and Dolls, Mame. Now his audition prospects are growing fewer and farther between, and he needs every job he can get. Lucinda turns off her BlackBerry to conserve the battery and starts opening drawers, looking for the charger. She plugs in the phone, then paces some more. She could call Neil, but after last night, she'd feel terrible if she disturbed him without a good reason. A ring in your coffee pot is a damned good reason. Yet maybe her vision of Carla means nothing. Maybe it wasn't a true vision at all. There's only one way to find out, Lucinda realizes, and heads for the bedroom to get dressed. Still in his robe and slippers, carrying a cup of coffee, Vic makes his way to the den, bypassing the television set and his recliner, where he spent all those idle months last year before Kitty came up with her brilliant idea.
Why don't you do that? She asked one night over dinner, as he told her about the investigative journalist he'd seen interviewed on the news program that morning.
Why don't I do what? Solve the Amelia Earhart disappearance?
No, Kitty said patiently.
Why don't you write a book about one of the unsolved cases you worked on?
I can't do that.
Why not?
Because I'm not a writer.
Kitty just looked at him. He rubbed his unshaven jaw, looking back at her. The next morning, he sat down in front of the computer instead of the television. And so it began.
Even if I never get this thing published, he told Kitty a couple hundred pages in, at least I feel productive again.
You'll get it published. Over Thanksgiving, they visited their daughter Melody in Manhattan. One of her friends happens to be a literary agent. At Melody's urging, and with reluctance, Vic suspects, she agreed to take a look at his work in progress. He sent it to her a week later and promptly found himself negotiating with a major publisher by Christmas. Press releases went out after New Year's, announcing the upcoming publication of his book, On the Night Watch, chronicling his career obsession with a notorious serial killer. The book isn't slated for release until next year, and his official deadline is still months away. But he's almost finished with it. Before it goes to his editor, it has to be submitted to FBI headquarters for a review to make sure he isn't venturing into classified territory. Vic only wishes he could write a different ending, one that doesn't involve the night watchman fading into the shadows, eluding capture.
Mom, what are you doing?
Hearing Tess behind her, Cam gasps. Her coffee, her third cup, sloshes all over her robe and the slate floor of the sunken sunroom off the kitchen, where she's been patiently waiting for a decent hour to call Lucinda Sloane, or Mike, in the Mountain Time Zone. Actually, she tried Mike's cell earlier, heedless of the hour, but he must have been sleeping too soundly to hear it. She couldn't bring herself to call the main line of the condo he's sharing with his family. Waking everyone before dawn would require some kind of emergency, and that's not what this is.
Geez, Mom, sorry. I didn't mean to scare you to death.
Tess is wearing sweats and sneakers. Her hair is pulled back in a somewhat stubby ponytail, with loose strands escaping to frame her hazel eyes. For months now, she's been growing out the layers of her thick, light brown hair, but it's a slow process. Cam suspects that her boyfriend is the motive for Tess's trading her longtime sporty style for something a little more feminine.
They've been dating since the ordeal last summer that brought them together. He's a good kid, with the maturity to actually look Cam in the eye when she enters the room and call her Mrs. Hastings. But Tess, with a boyfriend, at 15, has taken some getting used to. At least she no longer goes to school with him. As committed as Cam and Mike were to public school, they opted to transfer her back to private last September. It wasn't just because she'd had a falling out with several of her closest friends, or because they wanted to keep her away from her new boyfriend. But after all she'd gone through, from being abducted to breaking her leg, to being the focus of all that media attention, even if she never appeared on air herself, they concluded that a fresh start was in order. She didn't return to the prestigious Cortland Academy not far from Montclair, where she'd gone to school through 8th grade. Instead, they'd sent her to an even more prestigious, but somehow much lower key, all-girls school in Manhattan. She joins Mike on his commute to the office every day. Rather than wait around for him after school, she takes the train back home again, and Cam picks her up at the station. Initially, they had set her up with a car service, desperate to keep her safe at any cost. But after a few weeks of that, Tess begged to be allowed to take public transportation. "All the kids do it, Mom," she informed Cam, the holdout. Cam doubts that, but Mike thought some independence was a good idea, and so did the child psychiatrist Tess was still seeing back then to help her process all that had happened. In the end, Cam relented. If Tess wants to be independent, the more power to her. After all,